developmental milestones for infants and toddlers changed for the first time in nearly two decades. We talk about the new guidelines from the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The CDC's developmental tracking campaign is called Learn the Signs, Act Early, the goal being to track your child's development and act early if there's a concern. And there's an app for that in the CDC's free Milestone Tracker app. Is there anything your child does or does not do that concerns you? How closely do you track your baby's milestones, their actions and movements, their speaking? What do you wonder about with the new guidance? 800-642-1234. Dr. Dipesh Nafsaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also a clinical associate professor of human development and family studies. Dr. Nafsaria, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. I'm pleased to be here.
Well, let's start with some understanding of these checklists. Explain what are these developmental milestones that are being published by the American Academy of Pediatrics and the CDC?
Yeah, thanks for asking. You know, child development is amazingly important because it's really a barometer of brain development, of what children are exposed to or not exposed to. And it really lays a foundation for their lifelong capabilities going long into the future. So we focus a lot on these because there's no scan or blood test or anything like that that replaced a direct observation that healthcare providers can do, that parents can do, that others who are around children can do. So the question always is, what does it mean, you know, when a child is not walking as early as they should, or not saying the number of words that we expect, or things like that? So it's one of our ways of saying, how is a child doing in terms of brain development? And the milestones themselves, you know, children haven't changed, but how we think about them as professionals has changed. And that's really what went into these updates.
Why did these developmental pediatricians, these experts, feel the need to make these changes now after leaving them untouched for nearly 20 years?
You know, it's interesting. The world of how we think about developmental milestones has changed even in my career. Huh. Prior to these milestones, the prior version being developed, there was sort of a whole bunch of different lists and checklists, and they went all over the place, and some were designed for research and not really for use every day. So when these came out, they were pretty good. But one of the things they did was they said, okay, if a child is doing such and such by 12 months of age, then 50% of kids are expected to be doing that at that age, and 50% are not. So as a healthcare provider, if I don't see the child doing that, I might say, well, you know, half of them aren't supposed to be doing this yet. It's fine. Okay. Well, that might mean we leave something be and a few months pass. And then next time, oh, now there's quite a bit of delay. And time's important, right? If there's something that concerns us, we should be getting on top of it, because the earlier you intervene, the better it is, the better the outcomes. So in these milestones, they changed it to a 75-25 split. So at that 12 months of age, we expect that 75% of kids should be doing whatever milestone is listed. So if they're not doing it, okay, I'm not saying there's automatically a problem, but what I'm saying is we should be asking more questions, investigating more thoroughly, and maybe sending for further evaluation and possibly therapy if needed.
Let me reintroduce you here. We're talking with Dr. Dipesh Nafsaria, an associate professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, as we look at childhood milestones and what the guidelines say. You can join in. What questions do you have about these new milestones recently announced by the American Academy of Pediatrics? Do you have a young child? Are you concerned about their development in pandemic times? 800-642-1234. Dr. Nafsaria, you know, what I notice as a parent, and surely you notice as well, is that each kid takes a different path in their development. Some of my kids learn to tie their shoes super easily, almost intuitively. And, some of my kids, it was a struggle that lasted years. Like, you know, what do you not understand about bunny ears? But that is just one indicator, one small specific detail. Can you speak to looking collectively, looking holistically at the child's development when you assess whether something warrants further testing?
Yeah, that's a great point. And as also someone who struggled with shoelaces for quite a few years, it's not always just about one milestone, right? Mm-hmm. It's about looking at the total picture of fine motor skills and all. And remember, even with these milestones, they've baked into it some room for variation. Some mm-hmm. skills take a little longer. Some skills take less. What worries me is the child who is so delayed that all of a sudden we're looking at, say, for example, a 2 or 2.5 year old, and there's almost no words, right? Mm. Yes, a very, very tiny number of those kids will suddenly start speaking. I have a friend who was in that category, right? But we know that most kids, if they're not talking by then, okay, something, we need to ask more questions, right? It's not a diagnosis yet, but we need to be saying, what's going on here? You know, is there autism in play? Is there some other language delay? Is there a hearing issue that somehow got missed or developed or things like that? So it helps us kind of monitor what that general progression is. We're not there to worry about one milestone or one small skill. We're there to really look at the total picture. And I might add, these new milestones have also made some efforts to be inclusive in many ways. For some families, you know, socially, culturally, et cetera, some of the things we ask about may not be key. An example we used to use was we used to ask about whether a kid could pedal a tricycle. Well, guess what? Tricycles are shockingly expensive. So mm-hmm. for some families and economic groups, there was no opportunity to pedal a tricycle. So it was not a great question.
What about interventions here for autism, for social communication disabilities? Will these revised milestones make an impact on that?
I think what we'll find is that there's a higher likelihood that more children are being sent for at least more in-depth evaluation. Mm-hmm. You know, in primary care, there is no way that we can do an in-depth developmental assessment in the clinic, in the context of a regular checkup. But what we can do is say, you know, there's enough here that makes me concerned. I'd like to refer your child and you as a family to the BRT to 3 program, for example, and have someone do a more in-depth assessment, often in the family's home, so in the child's natural environment. And often, you know, I used to get letters back that said, they're actually not significantly delayed or it's minimal, right? Great, wonderful. If I don't actually get some letters like that back, then I'm probably not referring enough kids because that means I may miss a few. And we do know, as I'm fond of telling some of our trainees, it's not early intervention if one, it's not early, and two, you don't intervene. Kind of the wait and see approach is strangely dangerous. We don't want to overdo it, but there's a little too much wait and see when it comes to development sometimes.
What about if a parent is reluctant to take those further steps? What do you talk about then?
Yeah, so, you know, this is where, honestly, I go back to the wonderful quote from Ted Lasso, right? Don't be judgmental, be curious. Tell me why this is a concern for you, or you seem worried when I mentioned that I'd like to have your child evaluated by BRT to 3. Can you say more about that? I want to make sure I'm answering all your questions as well as possible. Sometimes I think it's a disbelief that there's something going on, like, gee, my kid seems fine, or maybe they have had prior experiences with other kids that make them say, I don't think this is an issue. What are you saying here? There's also sometimes shame or guilt, right? There are sometimes still people out there who say things like, well, you know, that child is speech delayed because that mother didn't eat right during pregnancy, or they must have hit him on the head. You know, just silly, stupid things like that. There's a lot of judgment that we do of parents, unfortunately. And I think trying to take the judgment out of it and say, we are really invested in developing your child's potential to the greatest extent possible, that we want their talent to really shine through, I think helps bring it back to that central point. Or maybe there's other information. Maybe they misinterpreted a question that I asked. And when you ask in more depth, it's like, oh, okay, that's all fine.
Pediatrician Dipesh Nafsaria explaining the new guidelines for tracking childhood development, especially in that critical birth to 5 year time frame. How has your doctor helped you make sure your child is hitting the appropriate benchmarks for their age and development? Have you sought additional testing due to signs of a possible developmental delay? What was that like for you? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Nev Saria here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the checklist of developmental milestones for infants and toddlers. What has changed and why here on The Morning Show? I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The group of developmental pediatricians and experts hope that this new guidance will encourage parents to seek interventions earlier instead of waiting until the delays become more pronounced. And the updated checklist identifies behaviors that at least 75% or more of children can be expected to achieve between birth and 5 years. So how much weight do you put on child development milestones from the medical field? Is there a milestone that you want to learn more about in particular? 800-642-1234. Pediatrician Dipesh Navsaria stays with us. Let's go to Sarah in Green Bay. Hi, Sarah. What experience would you like to share?
Good morning. I was just going to say I'm an educator, so I feel like I'm pretty educated in terms of interventions and supports. But for my own child, when he was very young, I think we did notice some things were, quote unquote, not up to the what you're explaining here on the air. But I think my hesitancy is that I was very nervous that our family wouldn't be able to financially support our son for whatever he needed. In terms of his therapy, and when I found out that actually there are a million things available to him at no cost to us, it became a no-brainer. And I'm just wondering, how do you get the word out about all those things? Because even as an educator, I had to open up this whole new world of interventions and supports that I'd never heard of.
Sarah, thank you so much. Dr. Navsaria.
Sarah, thank you for those really valuable comments. And you're absolutely right. You know, it used to be way back when that children with developmental delays, if you couldn't afford therapy and intervention, then good luck, right? It wouldn't happen. That's been replaced by, I'm not saying it's perfect, but there's a lot of federal, state, and also local programs that allow all these things to happen. If nothing else, getting a birth to three intervention is generally at low or no cost, and often therapy is covered if that delay is significant. So I think making sure that all folks, parents, educators, healthcare providers are aware of that is really key.
I was really interested and didn't realize that the CDC now has this milestone tracker app that really you can open up and kind of follow. Have you checked that out?
Yeah, you know, I have looked at it. I think it's so important because it gives the information back to families about what we look at. And also, I think it can help validate sometimes what they're seeing. One of the most important things, it's sort of buried in the report, but it is important, that an open-ended question, mm-hmm. is there anything your child is doing or is not doing that concerns you? You know, believe it or not, that's a really sensitive question because parents spend hours upon hours upon hours with their children, and they notice things that we may not see or be able to observe through a yes-no question in a few minutes in the clinic. And one of the things I've also told trainees many times is if a parent says to you, I am concerned about my child's development, that alone should immediately raise the likelihood that you will investigate further. Right, including potential more screening and referral and things like that, because parents are often right. Now, occasionally, right, there's a completely unrealistic, you know, expectation, but the vast majority of the time, they're saying something doesn't seem right to me here. And usually, when you refer and get further evaluation, yep, they were absolutely right.
I do want to acknowledge that medicine is an art and a science, and doctors take a lot of factors into diagnosis. You've got what the parents are telling you. You've got symptoms, family history, these milestone mm-hmm. markers. What role does that intuition play, that gut feeling you have in the decisions you make in diagnosing your young patients who can't fully communicate with you?
You know, the amazing thing is many people say, oh, you know, young children can't communicate well. They communicate great. They just don't use the same fluency of oral language, right? They're not talking to us in the same way. But so much of it is, I think, us not forgetting as healthcare professionals, not forgetting to look at our patients, right? So I remember once walking into a room. So we've talked before about early literacy and the reach out and read intervention. Mm-hmm. I give a book to children at their checkups and talk to families and support them in shared reading and things like that. I remember walking into a room and handing a child who I think was about 12 months of age, holding out a board book to them. Now, usually at 12 months, most kids have stranger anxiety, right? They're looking up at you. Hey, you're a stranger who just walked in. What's going on here? What are you doing? You know, at least this is that acknowledgement. And this child just kind of barely glanced at me, just kind of looked at the book and then went back to whatever he was doing with a toy or his hands or whatnot. And I was like, my goodness, that doesn't feel right for this age. I actually expect this kid to kind of be like, who are you? Or maybe even start crying or run to their parent. These are all developmentally normal. That child actually had autism, you know? And I picked it up because I was looking to see what's happening here. I wasn't just simply saying, what are my checklist questions, right? Mm-hmm. So I think we need to remember how to relearn how to observe our patients and really think deeply about what's going on.
Dr. Dipesh Nafsaria with us, Associate Professor of Pediatrics, as we talk about childhood milestones. And you can join in. What questions do you have about these milestones? Do you have concerns about your child's development or a story about going through a diagnosis? 800-642-1234. As you mentioned reading, how important is a parent's interaction, a caregiver's interaction, talking with them, looking them in the eyes, reading with the child to that baby's overall development and meeting these milestones?
You know, I can't say it's important in that it is essential, right? Everything you just said is the single most powerful driver of child development. If you, there's no app, as a colleague of mine said, there's no app to replace your lap. There's no video. There's no toy that on its own drives development forward in young children. So when children have what we call strong, stable, supportive, nurturing relationships by caring, confident, capable caregivers, lots of C's there, around them, then all these developmental milestones are far more likely to go forward. I don't want to imply that when kids have developmental delay, that it's a deficiency or a problem on the part of the parent. Things happen sometimes despite our best efforts, but we know that they're much more likely to happen, particularly when parents feel like they're doing it right. And that's the importance of parent coaching, right? It's not just throwing a book at families. It's not just giving them a pamphlet. It's saying, hey, you've got it right. I mean, look, I'm a pediatrician. My kids are now in college, but I liked being told at our checkups that I was getting it right. Right? And we often don't remember to do that, to tell parents, hey, I think you're doing a good job.
Let's spend a moment on the pandemic, which really has slowed down so much of things in the world, including delaying well check visits for a time being. And certainly the learning, the development of some children and how they have had some learning loss in these times. How do you grapple with that, with learning and development with a pandemic?
Yeah, and certainly we want children caught up in terms of their checkups, partly because of things like development. Also, we want them up to date with all their immunizations. I mean, we've worried about, you know, in the middle of all this, potentially seeing measles outbreaks because of this delays in immunization and all. But here's the thing. I think on one hand, yes, children have been less likely to be around other children in early childhood settings, you know, schools playing, et cetera. But on the other hand, they're around their families much more. Census data from from 2020 shows that, hey, much more family mealtime, much more shared reading is going on because families have been together. So I wouldn't say that there's been necessarily a loss of developmental progress, that in families that have had the environments and have been stable in terms of their jobs and resources and all those sorts of things, that those families, it's just been a different kind of interaction in different ways. Sure, there's going to be a little bit of, you know, challenges in terms of reintegrating into large settings. I think even us grownups are going to have a hard time being in large groups for a while. Children are actually remarkably flexible.
Resilient.
And we'll just kind of, yeah, they'll go on, you know, as long as we have that good foundation for them.
Dr. Nafsaria, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Dr. Dipesh Nafsaria, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, Clinical Associate Professor of Human Development and Family Studies. Ahead this hour, we explore the link between music and health and that role of music therapists on the care team. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story of America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee. And please take care while listening as the story touches on racism and violence.
In 1930, three black teenagers were accused of murder in Indiana. After their arrest, an angry mob dragged two of the young men out of the jail and lynched them next to the courthouse. Then they came for the third boy, 16-year-old James Cameron. Here he is telling his story on WHYY's Fresh Air.
And then they began to yell for me like a favorite basketball or football player. They said, "We want Cameron, we want Cameron." And as the police cleared the path, I looked over into the faces of people as they were beating me along the way up to the tree. I was pleading for some kind of mercy, looking for a kind face, but I could find none. They got me up to the tree, and someone said, "Where's the rope?" They got a rope, and they put it around my neck, and they began to push me under the tree. And that's when I prayed to God. I said, "Lord, have mercy and forgive me my sins." I was ready to die.
But you heard a voice. What did
Yes.
the voice say?
The voice said, "Take this boy back. He had nothing to do with any killing."
Miraculously, the crowd let him go. Dr. James Cameron is supposedly the only person to survive a lynching in the United States. Cameron dedicated his life to sharing his story, the civil rights movement, and eventually landed in Milwaukee, where he founded America's Black Holocaust Museum. The museum's head griot, Reggie Jackson, says Cameron was moved after a trip to a Holocaust memorial in Israel with his wife.
And while they were standing there, they were both in tears, and he turned to his wife, Virginia, and he said, "Virginia, we need a museum like this in America to tell what happened to black people and all of those freedom-loving whites that have been with us along this journey."
He didn't start the museum until he was 74 years old.
That's America's Black Holocaust Museum virtual curator, Fran Kaplan.
He bought a boxing gym for a dollar. He had been collecting for years artifacts that people would send him, things like Ku Klux Klan outfits that they found in their attics in Milwaukee.
People from around the world came to this small museum in Milwaukee to hear the stories that Dr. Cameron shared. It became really something very unique because it was a telling of American history from a different perspective than the majority of us have ever had.
The museum's doors stayed open in the Bronzeville neighborhood for 20 years. It closed after Cameron passed away in 2006 at age 92.
So we have this exhibit which talks about life in Africa.
The museum has been resurrected. It's housed in a new physical building, but its doors are not open yet. Organizers continue to raise money to finish the displays and create an endowment. Jackson gives me a tour of some of the displays featuring African empires, slavery, and the Jim Crow era.
And as you kind of get further into the museum, you know, probably the most emotional part of the former museum was our simulated slaving ship.
Dr. Cameron's legacy lives on in this new museum.
He said on many, many occasions that the museum is designed to help people. It's not designed to hurt anybody. It's not designed to make people feel uncomfortable. This is as American as any other part of our history.
People are looking to change what's happening in race relations in this country. And Dr. Cameron was way out ahead of this. He emphasized that the truth would set you free.
This man who survived a lynching at the age of 16, who was forced to witness a lynching at the age of 8, found a way to not be a hateful person, found a way to take tragic events that happened in his life and use that experience, those emotions, to grow into a person who wanted to make the world better for everybody.
Go to our website, wisconsinlife.org, where you can learn so much more about Dr. James Cameron's life and the eventual reopening of America's Black Holocaust Museum. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to the role of music therapy in healthcare. It's increasingly being used to help treat brain conditions like PTSD and depression, Alzheimer's. Scientists are trying to puzzle out how music therapy actually affects the brain. The Cleveland Clinic says it has a positive effect on a wide variety of disorders like cardiac conditions, substance abuse, and autism. Have you tried music therapy? How did it go? Or have you seen a music therapist working at a hospital or nursing home? What did you observe? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dale Taylor is Professor Emeritus of Music and Theater Arts at UW-Eau Claire and founder of its music therapy program. Dale, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Good morning. A music therapist, not just a musician. Can you explain how music therapists are specially trained?
Yes, the music therapy program at any university involves basically four phases of training. There are, in addition to general education courses that every student at the university takes, the music therapist has to be a music major. In order to even get into the program, you have to audition on a musical instrument because it's essential that the music that a music therapist uses in therapy be musical. And it has to be music that is tailored to the needs of specific patients that we treat. So it's not just turning on a radio or a recording and playing music for someone and expecting them to get well. It rarely, if ever, works that way. The music therapist has to make music, has to adapt music, has to plan music and carry out the musical experiences. So that's why they have to be a musician. And then there are behavioral sciences that have to do with teaching a person about the physical, mental, emotional, and social behavior of human beings, what they are normally, what their disabilities and maladies are, and some of the ideas and ways that people have gone about, different authorities have gone about trying to treat those disorders. And then the third area is coursework, the major coursework in music therapy, which brings those two together. And then the fourth area is clinical training. And when I first started as a music therapy student, the clinical training didn't occur until the internship, the six-month internship, after all of the rest of that had occurred. But since then, now we actually start students when they're freshmen in college, actually, and sometimes before that, we get high school students coming to observe music therapists. But in college, they're assigned as freshmen to observe, and then as sophomores, they begin to assist. And then as juniors, they're actually assigned a patient or two so that they can start practicing the techniques under the tutelage of their professors.
So many skills, many skills and talents coming together. Why should someone undergo music therapy? When you talk about patients, who are you speaking about?
Okay, one of the popular misconceptions about music therapy is that it's something anyone can do, and anytime you're playing music for or with a person with a disability, you're doing music therapy, and that is, nothing is further from the truth. You may be using recreational music and music listening, but that is not music therapy. Music therapy is, the word therapy means treatment, and music therapy is used when there's a person who really needs treatment for a disorder or a maladjustment, something that the person is having to deal with that is abnormal. So when you mentioned, I think earlier, the word autism, an autistic person needs treatment to try to deal with the world in a better way. And when music therapy is used, what we're doing is we're using the music to activate that person's brain so that a number of things happen when we do that. For one, music has been shown through many years of research and demonstrations and brain scans to activate the entire brain at once. And so when you're using music with an autistic person, you're bringing more of the brain to bear on each task that you're asking that person to do. You're also activating more pathways within the brain so that the various parts of the brain can communicate with each other much better than they can without the music. And that's one of the theories of autism, is that there's something wrong in the person's brain that interferes with the different parts of the brain to communicate with each other. And a third thing that you're doing with music when you're treating autism is that you're providing a common ground for the therapist and the autistic person to communicate with each other through.
I just want to jump in here because there's this assumption that the patient must have some particular music ability to benefit from music therapy or some proclivity. Is that true? Is there anything to that?
You are absolutely right that there is that assumption, but there is nothing to that. Most of the patients that I've seen were not musicians, were not trained musicians. Now, if and when, and I have had many patients who were accomplished musicians, the only difference then is that we use different music, because the music that we use with any particular patient works best if it's music from that person's background. And again, that is based on brain functioning, because the music that works best, we find, is the music that matches the stored neural impulse patterns that already exist in that person's brain. So if you can imagine working with a schizophrenic person who really is not that well in touch with reality, that person may or may not really know what kind of music they like best. But what we do is we use music to match that person's already lived experience of music, and that way we can access their brain functioning better to activate their brain.
Dale Taylor with us, founded the music therapy program at UW-Eau Claire. What questions do you have about a music therapy session? Do you have a background in music or play an instrument and want to know about credentialing in music therapy? Is your loved one struggling with a health condition and you think music therapy could help? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dale Taylor here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring music interventions in healthcare and the role of a music therapist on the healthcare team. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Professional music therapists are board certified, and according to the American Music Therapy Association, about 20% of music therapists receive third-party reimbursement for the services they provide, making it comparable to other allied health professions like occupational therapy, like physical therapy. What is your story about music therapy? Still time to talk about it, 800-642-1234. Dale Taylor founded the music therapy program at UW-Eau Claire, is with us for about 9 more minutes. Dale, I'm wondering if you could take us inside your personal story, how you got involved with music therapy.
Okay, well, I'm from Topeka, Kansas. It's interesting that you had that spot about the American Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee, because I grew up in Topeka, Kansas, and was there during the time of Brown versus Board. And I was kind of well known as a musician. And interestingly enough, my first job out of college when I graduated from the University of Kansas was in Milwaukee, at Milwaukee County Mental Health Center. But in Kansas, in Topeka, growing up, I used to like to sing with guys on the corner. And when I got into high school, one of the courses that I did best in was music, along with mathematics and psychology and things like that. And my dad worked at the Santa Fe Railroad in the Treasury Department. And so we got to travel a little bit. So when I got to college, I looked for a major that would combine my love of mathematics, travel, music, and science. Yeah. Thanks a lot. Good luck with that.
I'm not going to say it. Go ahead.
I know what you're thinking, because I would have thought the same thing. But as I looked around at various majors and what they involved, music therapy was and has proven to be the perfect combination of all of that. As I got into it and went through my bachelor's, master's, and doctorate at the University of Wisconsin, I was able to change the field somewhat from an adjunctive field in which music therapists kind of played music and then see what's going on. But if anyone asked them, what is the music doing? Why is music therapeutic? They really couldn't answer the question. So what I did once I became a professor in the field is to do research to find out why music is therapeutic. And what I landed on was a scientific explanation of how music affects the brain and changes the brain. Because when you think about it, literally every patient that we treat, from the schizophrenic to the person with severe brain damage, which I did experience, all the way to eating disorders, or even when music is used in surgery or obstetrics in a general hospital, what we're doing is trying to change what's going on in the brain. Whether we're trying to change the brain's perception of reality or the brain's ability to receive and process pain stimuli. The music has very definite and scientifically proven ways of decreasing the ability of pain stimuli to come up to consciousness in the brain. Mm-hmm. It also changes, we can use music to change the way a person relates to reality when we're treating eating disorders, for example. And I've described techniques for all of those in my book.
Dale Taylor with us, Professor Emeritus at UW-Eau Claire, founder of the university's music therapy program. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Daniel is here from Menasha. Daniel, hi.
Hi.
What is on your mind?
Yeah, so I've been listening along, and I just had a question for Professor Taylor about, I'm thinking about like Hollywood and TV, how it shows like an Alzheimer's patient that maybe hears the song played at their wedding that they dance to or something, and all of a sudden it triggers something, and, you know, the companion and the patient also, you know, they share a memory of that time. And, how does therapy... Is that a misconception? Does the person need to listen to music therapy 24/7 or is it more like, kind of mm-hmm. occupational therapy where you kind of go in for bursts of help and then it helps open, you know, neural pathways and such.
I gotcha. Daniel, thank you for that question. Dale.
Yes, that's a very perceptive question. And the answer is yes and no to what he said. What is happening is that when a person listens to music, and let me preface this by saying that music therapists have been observing this phenomenon for decades and decades. A person who may have severe dementia, maybe Alzheimer's type or just regular dementia, and they may not even be able to say their own name or recognize their close relatives. But when the music is played, they can do all of that and carry on normal conversations and chill memory. What is happening is, as I said, the music is we need to understand what dementia does. Dementia literally destroys parts of the brain. So the brain is basically, you could think of it as kind of wasting away in terms of its ability to function. So the various parts that don't function. And so but as I said before, the music activates all parts of the brain at once. And so the music is stored in many different parts of the brain at once. So when a person with dementia hears music that activates the stored neural patterns that are already there, it activates those parts and gets the brain parts communicating with each other better. And a person then can function pretty normally in terms of their ability to process information, communicate, remember, and even movement abilities, such as he alluded to. And that is something that happens during the music. It's not something that continues very long after the music, but the music's ability to stimulate the whole brain at once does help the person function more normally for a time.
Dale, in our last moments together, wondering as you look ahead to music therapy in the healthcare setting, I mentioned earlier about private insurance or how music therapy is in hospital or nursing home settings. What do you see in the future as part of the medical team?
What we're doing, that's a good question. What we're doing right now is there are more and more music therapists who are getting into the study of the neuroscientific study of music therapy. In other words, there is a growing and better funded, actually government funded, relationship between neuroscience and music. And that relationship will allow us to become more objective about our ability to participate in diagnostic procedures, to monitor changes as we go through treatment, and to branch out to new areas of treatment. So the neuroscientific basis, I think, is the future.
Dale, thank you for joining us.
You're quite welcome. Thanks for having me.
Dale Taylor, Professor Emeritus of Music and Theater Arts at UW-Eau Claire. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.